WGTS speaking. But to go back 60 or 70 years or more ago into the history of Foxhall, with its varied modes of life, it's very hard to imagine. They were fairly large families. They were considered quite natural. Parents did not seem to reason or wonder whether or not it was possible to provide for an addition to the family. If a new baby arrived, it was always received. It always received a welcome. And no matter how many were already in the family, there was always a place in the home and in the mother's heart for the little newcomer. If the father of the family happened to be taken under tragic circumstances, the mother would shoulder the burden. No one knew how she managed or from what source her strength and courage came, but she reared her family. The men, of course, looked on their work as part of their life. It was part of their lot in life. In most cases, it was the whole of their life. Their one thought was to have a job, to provide for their wives and their families. The wages were accepted whether much or little. If a man was lucky, of course, he was lucky. And if he was not lucky, well, he accepted the situation as it was and made the best of it, and it carried on. I thought that little chorus was too good to leave it out. I don't know where it came from. So now we'll get around to Foxdale.
Foxdale, as we of the present generation know it, and Foxdale of 65 or 70 years ago, according to how it has been presented or painted, would seem to be two absolutely different places, not by any means the same village. Foxdale of 65 or 70 years ago was a place of life and energy, a hive of industry. From early morning until evening, in fact all through the night, the work of mining the lead and silver went on. Labor was cheap but plentiful, and large veins of fertile mineral wealth was there just for the taking. But Foxdale as it stands today is depressing and lost. It has been described as the city of the dead. While rebuilding of houses and bungalows has enriched and beautified all other localities in the island, Foxdale has been left. And when one views the mine wastes and old-looking houses, it seems to intensify the feeling of desolation and loss. Of course, that is when it is viewed in the light of the Foxdale that was. A newcomer would accept the situation as it is today without question. Foxdale of 65 or 70 years ago was the center. Farms and crops and farmers' sons and labourers were all subsidiaries of the great enterprise of mining. At the head was Captain Kitto. He was held almost as a semi-god. He could build or he could destroy. His house had the appearance of a mansion, and he interviewed personally the underground staff. Work was offered, always an offer, at a small wage, a paltry sum for a week's work. But work was still very precious. It was work to live, or work or starve. There was no other provision, no unemployment benefit. In extreme cases of semi-starvation, the church or the poor relief might reluctantly dole out 2 and 6 a week. But of course the captain of the mines in his exalted position lived above all this kind of thing. He travelled by gig with a high-stepping mare. And when travelling to St. John's from Foxtel would be passing the little cottage where Grandfather Tia spent his retirement. The old man would sometimes be standing at his gate when the great man would pass with his horse and trap. And the captain would call out, "Good morning, Dan." And the old man would come in to Grandmother Tia and he would say, "Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Dan." That's all the respect the captain has for a man who is 30 years older than himself. Good morning, Dan. The second in command of the mine was a man named Harry Clark. He was rough and ruthless with those who were under his command. He was in charge of the surface staff, the wash and the washers. His oaths would explode a dictionary, and his curses would shock even the devil himself. It was said that he was more or less his own boss, as the captain never interfered with him. It was said too that he held some sinister influence over the captain. And this could well have been true, as the captain owned a farm a few miles further south, and the mine stones and material and men were used almost continually in improving this bit of private enterprise. Wages paid to the miners working underground was 18 shillings to 21 shillings per week. If a miner and his partner happened to be on piecework, and he were entitled to say 23 or 24 shillings for that particular week, there were always convenient reductions to be made, such as sharpening jumpers and picks and the new handles. And so the average in the pay packet would be sustained. One miner working underground lost an arm, and he was given a surface job which entitled him to 15 shillings a week. But as he was minus an arm, there was 1 shilling per week knocked off, and he only got 14 shillings a week. The washers or surface workers' pay varied from 8 shillings or 9 shillings to perhaps 12 shillings. The hours worked were from 7 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. In the dark winter mornings, boys and men would be groping around with the aid of candles and lanterns. Big, lusty, strong young men with healthy appetites, having to be fed and clothed and boots provided out of 9 shillings a week. The man who lost an arm, having a family to provide for, left the mines and became the village postman. And for years he tramped the distances from Foxtel to St. John's, leaving Foxtel in the morning at 7 o'clock and finishing up in the evening after delivering 2 posts in the day, finishing up at 9 p.m. It is a familiar sight to see him in the darkness with his little poor paraffin lamp fastened to his breast. He called at one house in the darkness and knocked on the door, and a window opened above his head and a woman's voice said, "There is nobody in, John Evan." And his answer was, "Come on thee down here and get thee letters." So life went on. There were deep channels conducting water from the surrounding hills to the mines for use in the wash. These channels would be called a race, the mine's race. One chap who had sheep grazing alongside one of these mine races, sheep was drowned. And so the captain sent for him to come to his office with the idea of compensating him for his loss. Before leaving for the captain's office, this chap's good wife primed him and said, "Now, you ask 35 shillings for that sheep and don't take any less. No matter how much the captain may try to beat you down, don't you take any less than 35 shillings. And so the man went up to see the captain about his sheep, and he was ushered into the office, into the presence of the captain. And the captain said to him, "Well, John, or Fred, we're sorry for your loss. We're sorry that your sheep was drowned, but we'll make it all right for you. We'll pay you for the sheep. What did you value the sheep at?" 35 shillings, said John. So the captain said, "Well, that's all right, John. We'll give you £2. We'll make it £2 for the sheep." "Oh, no, you won't," said John. "Oh, no, you won't. I'm taking 35 shillings for the sheep and nothing less." The captain's reply was, "Go home, John, and send your wife up here." The mines closed in 1911, but for some years it had been declining. The price of lead was low, at 9 shillings a ton. But the mine was only closed 2 years when the price of lead rose from £9 a ton to £40 a ton. But for a while there had been the handwriting on the wall. The mines were very deep and without proper ventilation, unhealthy. Miners contracted lung or miners disease. Strong men in the prime of their lives would succumb to this distressing disease. The tombstones in the churchyard will show name after name of men dying from 46 to under 60 years of age. So that was the story of their lives. Just a small circle of home and family and work. Now they have gone, all of that generation, and nothing to show that they ever lived apart from the names and the tombstones. The places of worship, the church and chapels bear their undying witness, of course, to the life that is eternal. And the words of the funeral service read over rich and poor alike bears its record. "I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die." Entwined with the history of the mines is the story of the Foxtel Band, or bands. Because for a while, at any rate, there were two bands. They were designated the Rooks and the Frogs. The band called the Rooks was so called because this bandmaster, Tom Tier, lived in Slewellian Farm, where there was a rookery. And the band called the Frogs got its name because of its members wearing a type of yellow uniform. The band served a twofold purpose. It was a healthy interest for its members, the practices providing fellowship and cheer, and also the utilizing of talent. Then it was also an asset to the neighborhood, as its music provided a great attraction for any special event. To the listener, whether musical or not, the music of the band is rich and sublime and finds a response in every heart. Tom Tier, bandmaster, composer, cornet player, and organist, could have been classified as a musical genius. He could sit down and compose a piece of special music for a special occasion, and every part in complete harmony, without a stop or a hesitation. In after years, he became bugler in the Boer War, but died of pneumonia. Any event in the district was supported and enhanced by the attendance of the band. Then on club day, this meant, of course, the Rechabite Club. The club in full regalia marched, and their march headed by the band. The lilting marching songs added a springs to tired legs and muscles. The usual route taken would be up to the plantation of Barule, and then down through Lower Foxhill as far as what was known as the Milestone, and back then to the house of the captain of the mines, where on the lawn the band would give its items of music, and then all and sundry would be regaled with pop and biscuits. The pop in those days, which was called cider, was a delicious cooling drink, as palatable as nectar or honey. I can dimly remember being in the first, last, and only march as a young Rechabite, wearing a large sash which had been loaned to me for the occasion. It was a sweltering hot day, and I would be 11 or 12 at the time. And as I watched with anxious eyes the distribution of the pop, and when it came to my turn, there was only ginger beer left. The ginger beer was, or seemed to be, 95% ginger. I have not yet got over the disappointment of this affair, although nearly 60 years have gone by. There were about half a dozen or more bands on the island at that time, and these would take part occasionally in a band contest. The occasion which I have in mind, the contest was held in Peel. And in the Foxtrot band there was one player, he played a heavy instrument known as the bombarn, or bombarn, I don't know which, is no matter anyway. This man's lungs would have compared with the lungs of Jehu's horse, whom the said Jehu drove furiously. Also in the Laxey band there was a man of similar ability playing the same instrument. And it was prearranged that when the band should be assembled together for the final blast before departure, this usually took place on Peel Marketplace, Market Square, when the contest was in Peel. And the Foxtrot player and the Laxey player would be standing in such a position that there would be, that each player would be blasting into each other's ears. This was done, and the result was colossal. It was told afterwards that these two players on that occasion were responsible for a crack appearing in the steeple of Braddon Church, and it sometime afterward had to be dismantled. With the story of the band too is entwined the story of Dick Tridley, or his proper name was Richard Quirk. He was a member of the band, or perhaps I shouldn't put it, he was always there. You often get this type attaching themselves to Salvation Army bands or wherever there is music. The music seems to attract them. And Dick was accepted in that light. He knew nothing of music apart from two lines of the old 100th, which he played slowly and solemnly. Oh, bo, 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 bo. He had his own instrument, and if And if the band were having a day out, they would have a whip round so that Dick could accompany them. They would pay his expenses. Sometimes when there would be a band practice, one of the members would put the piece of music, perhaps a new piece in which they were engaged, he'd put it upside down into Dick's holder. And he would say to Dick, have a look at that one, Dick, let's see what you think about that one. And Dick would look at it very critically indeed, and without altering his suspicion, would put his instrument to his lips and play, oh, bo, 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 bo. Then he would say, I like that one, it's a good one, I like it. On one occasion, half a dozen of the band's men were having a trip to Douglas a Saturday afternoon. And of course, Dick wanted to accompany them. They also took their instruments with them. And on returning, they dismounted from the train at St. John's to walk to Foxhill. And when they got off the train to head for Foxhill, they said to Dick, now, Dick, we are putting you in the position of bandmaster from here to Foxhill. You're in sole charge of us. Whatever orders you give, we must obey them. The fact of being made bandmaster and in full charge was exciting, to say the least of it, for Dick. And not only did it lend wings to his legs and feet, but also it lent wings to his music. But these others had their own thoughts regarding this affair before they reached Foxhill. Dick got his regiment into line, all ready for the march, and put his instruments to his lips to sound the marching song. Oh, bo, 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 bo. And off they started. Every few hundred yards, up would go his instrument, and the others had to follow suit and play along with Dick. Bo, 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 bo. We were very glad indeed to reach Foxhill. Then in the band was a drummer boy, Alfie Rushen. My father explained to me that if a young man was keen on joining the band and had not the musical qualifications, he would be given the position of drummer, and he would hammer away at the drum so long as he knew when to stop. My father explained to me too that a newcomer to the band would nearly always give himself away by giving a honk when there would be a pause in the music. It's rather surprising, but an untrained and unqualified man, knowing nothing or very little of the rudiments of music, can yet fit in and carry out a part, which adds up to the sum total of the whole. Which reminds me of a story told to me by the late F. H. Crow. To put the story into right perspective, here in this lovely island home of ours, when music bears the designation PP, it means that that particular part has to be sung very softly. Mr. Crow said he sung in a choir at Crunkabody, and into this choir was a strong, heavy, deep bass singer. And he said to Mr. Crow on one occasion during practice, I like to see PP coming up in the music. Plenty of power. So to come back to Foxhill Band with the drummer boy, Alfie Rushen, he stayed at Slewillian as a farmhand. He became ill with pneumonia and died. The full band turned out to his funeral. And in Slewillian, the road or lane leading from the farmhouse to the main road winds through an orchard of trees, and over a railway bridge, and then on down to a river crossing the river by an improvised bridge. My father said he never heard anything so touching as the band playing the funeral dirges as they wended their way down the lane through the trees to the river and to the main road. So Alfie Rushton finished his short earthly course. His tombstone, erected by the members of the band, bears the inscription, Alfred Rushton, aged 26 years. The mystery of life. The moving finger writes, having writ moves on, nor all its piety nor wit can lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all one's tears wash out a one word of it. Were I so tall to reach the pole, or grasp the ocean in my span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. Hoxtel of 60 to 70 years ago was really a home of Methodism. The three chapels were well filled every Sunday evening. Services were afternoon and evening. The Foxtel Village Chapel would be filled to full capacity for the evening service. The services were inspiring, helpful, and really provided a feast for hungry souls. On one occasion, I, as a young preacher, taking the evening service at the village chapel, something had hindered me, and I was late for the service. I came into a crowded congregation waiting for their preacher and got up to commence the service. And in my excitement, I gave out to the wrong hymn. But however, that was rectified. But it came to the opening prayer, and then in the opening prayer, when I came to repeat the Lord's Prayer, I could not bring it to mind, and there was an embarrassing silence. And my old class leader, sitting down in the middle of the congregation, started up and saved the situation. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. There was always a short prayer meeting at the close of the evening service, and three or four of the brethren would engage in prayer. This too was a real live part in the service of worship. And no amount of repeating catechisms or intoning or reciting litanies would compare with a full service of this kind for calming the troubled breast or feeding the hungry soul. Here may the dead be made to live, the dumb to sing, the deaf to hear, and do thou to the humble give pardon and peace instead of fear. Make this, O Lord, of thine own abode, thy presence in these courts be given. Be this indeed to the house of God, and this in truth the gate of heaven. There were a number of able and eloquent preachers in the district. In those days, these men, faithful to their calling, went out Sunday by Sunday to their respective appointments. One very prominent preacher was, of course, my grandfather, Daniel Teer. He was considered a great preacher, not because of having a full grasp of theology, but rather because of his unique manner in putting his message across. His sermon would be biblical and clear of any heresy, but would almost always be tinged with humor. On one occasion he was preaching about Paul, and he said, Paul? Paul? I didn't think much of Paul. And then, like an afterthought, he said, before he was converted, Grandfather Dan used a horse and trap to get to his appointments, and he would usually carry two or three other preachers along with him. Sometimes they would have a day preaching on the south, and Grandfather Dan would say to the people, "It's not for my qualifications that I'm here today, but because of the good men that I am bringing along with me." He liked a horse that could get along. When he went to buy a horse which might be suitable for the trap, he would not trouble so much about spavins or splints on the horse's legs, but he would say to the seller, "Can he go, boy?" If he could go, that was all that was required. The congregations were appreciative of good, sound sermons, and a Sunday evening sermon would provide material for discussion during the following day, especially at lunchtime amongst the miners. The Sunday school anniversaries of those days were always of paramount importance. They were always held in the open air when the weather permitted, and the choirs of the district would combine for each anniversary, and for weeks beforehand would be trained by qualified conductors for these special events. For many years, the late Mr. W.E. Collister acted as conductor, or might I say, to use the Italian word, as maestro. He also accompanied his choirs to the Guild Festival in Douglas for quite a number of years and carried home many laurels. He was efficient, neat, capable, and patient. On one occasion, he was presented at the Guild Festival with an ornamental baton, a prize for being the neatest conductor. That was, of course, in conducting, and did not refer to dress, or even that might have qualified as well. The choirs, like the brass band, were always a background for special services and events, and did quite a lot to keep the young people together and give them an interest in something that was worthwhile. In music, whether it's choirs or band music or solos, the choice of music or song counts for almost everything. Therefore, the conductor who has a good taste for choice and rendering can achieve the desired effect both for the singer and listeners. The Foxhill Combined Choir had in my early days an anthem of which the choir never seemed to grow tired of listening to, nor the congregation of hearing. It was repeated again and again. It was called "Jesus of Nazareth Passeth By." Into the singing of this anthem it seemed as it reached out towards zenith and grasped at joy and ecstasy until a triumphant finish. "And Jesus said unto him, and Jesus said unto him, it shall be done, receive thy sight, thy faith hath saved thee." My wife in the background says I ought to try some throat lozenges. The story of Foxhill anniversary would not be complete without mention being made of the friends who year by year have come across from Crompton and Widnes. They have been coming for three generations. The older folk have one by one gone to their heavenly home and are now members of the celestial choir, the triumphant church, and are before the throne of God. The younger people still continue to come and bring an atmosphere of cheer and goodwill and friendly fellowship. For many years, these good folk and their forebears timed their holidays so that they would coincide with the anniversary, followed next day by the Sunday school picnic. They are and were a free, friendly, and most likable people, and had one or two roots in the past of relationship on the island. They did not claim to be singers, but their presence added to the quality of the company. And if the men folk were designated to lift the collection, it added to their pleasure. I well remember what a pleased expression was on the face of Mr. Hewson as he carried so majestically the collection plate, which contained a cluster of £1 notes. Mr. Glover, another visitor from the same church, was a preacher and occupied the pulpit on two occasions for the anniversary. He loved to preach in the Manx pulpits. He and I travelled hundreds of miles together over here. On one occasion we were visiting my mother, and as we were travelling back from Foxhall to Douglas and talking of the things that preachers usually talk about, he stopped in his conversation and said, "We'll talk it all over in the glory land, Brother Tia. Of course, he has gone there first." Then for 3 years in succession, I preached for the Crunton Harvest Festival and told them not to invite me again, as I could not say no, and it was not too easy to fit all this kind of thing in. But meeting so many good friends in their own ground kind of thing gladdened my heart and enriched my soul. Then in early years, a regular visitor was Mr. Job Stott. He was a man of ability and quality. He had J.P. to his name. He came very regularly to Foxhall Anniversary and requested that his favorite hymn, "Forever with the Lord," be put on the hymn sheet. And for this pleasure and privilege, he was putting £1 on the collection plate. Of course, £1 in those days meant quite a lot more than what £1 means today. He has gone home now many years, but this hymn still goes on the hymn sheet. But now it appears as a hymn in memory and a dismissal hymn. And when some of us older scholars go back to Foxhall for the anniversary, and we try to join in the singing of this hymn, there comes rather a strange lump in our throat, as flood after flood of memory fills our hearts and minds as we recall the days that are gone and the names of those who used to worship in the chapel here. And some or other, we cannot join in the singing of the hymn. "Forever with the Lord, all man, so let it be. Life from the dead is in that word, 'tis immortality. Here in the body pent, absent from him I roam, yet nightly pitch my moving tent, a day's march nearer home. Forever with the Lord, how should I love that word? And oft repeat before the throne, forever with the Lord, that resurrection word, that shout of victory, once more, forever with the Lord. Amen, so let it be."
I'm just putting a piece in here to finish off this track, really. And I had a few stories concerning Manxland in mind, but I'll leave them till sometime again.
WGT is speaking. I will tell you in a moment why I start off with my name. But first of all, let me say that Mona has asked me to make a contribution to this tape of hers, and it's a very great pleasure indeed for me to do so for various reasons. First, Mona is such a kind, friendly, and helpful young woman herself that anyone would find it hard to say no to any request of hers. Then this tape, I understand, will be sent to the Reverend and Mrs. Philip Rees. I'm using this official designation because who can say who may yet be listening to this tape, perhaps even a bishop. And if I was to refer to Kathleen and Philip, it might not be the proper thing. Just suppose, for instance, I had to say something about the vicar of Foxdale, and I was to refer to him as Charlie. That would be absolutely improper. Then I give my name because a few years ago, before I had this tape recorder, I had a chap here from Douglas was finalizing for me a tape that I was sending to America. This tape was, of course, well thought out and prepared, with stories and anecdotes and all that kind of thing. And when I had finished finalizing this tape, this chap asked me to put a speech of introduction on a tape for him. He was giving an entertainment of sacred music records to the old age pensioners in Douglas. And he wanted an introductory speech for this occasion, and he thought that I could do it for him. Well, my mind had been concentrated on the tape going to America, getting it. So it wasn't easy for me to switch over my mind from America to talking to the old age pensioners in Douglas. However, I did my best. I said what a great pleasure it was to speak to them. I knew of their happy fellowship and had been in their hall and seen them relaxed and at ease, very comfortable and enjoying each other's conversation. And I hoped also that they would enjoy the records which they were going to listen to this evening. When I asked this chap what I had said, whether what I had said would be all right, he answered, "No use whatever, no use at all." In the first place, he said, "You never give your name. They don't know who's talking," he said. "They don't know you. All they're hearing is a voice on the tape." He said, "You should have told them your name, and you should have told them all about yourself, about your rheumatism and your arthritis, and how you went away to that doctor in Manchester and what he did about you." "Oh," he said, "that's no use. You'll have to try and do better than that." Well, he blotted out what I had already said, and then I started again. I think he expected me to put something more in line with what he'd heard on the tape that I was sending to America, but of course that was all cut and dried and all in its place, and it had been studied, and I couldn't do all that in just a minute's thinking. However, at the second try, I seemed to get on better, and I worked one or two anecdotes in, and when I had finished, I said to him, "Well, how will that do?" "Oh," he said, "it's better," he said, "it's better," he said, "but it's not as good as what it ought to be," he said, "and anyway," he said, "it's still too short." So that was that. Then, may I say too that I'm very glad to share in this round of fellowship and friendship, because I know all of you so well. I can recall over 50 years ago when Mona's folk used to worship at a little chapel called Gordon. It has been closed now for some years and has been turned into a dwelling house. Their family were there. There were four sisters. Mona's mother would be one of them. And these four sisters, I remember, sat very prim and proper. And by the look on their faces, they agreed with all that the preacher said. There was always a very good service. The singing was always of the best, and everyone enjoyed it to the full. Mr. Lancelot Quayle was the organist, and he could draw out the best in the organ and also in the singers. Sitting alongside of him was Lewis Moore with a cornet. Rather a strange thing, but if a man is married, he gets the title of Mr. But if he's unmarried, no matter what his age may be, he always goes by his own name, nothing more and nothing less. And so Lewis Moore enhanced the singing of Gordon Chapel with his cornet. The clear notes of the cornet could be heard in all the congregational singing throughout all the hymns. It's wonderful how everyone makes their own contribution and fits into their own sphere in life. Lewis Moore with his cornet, Lancelot Quayle at the organ, the preacher in the pulpit, the mother in the home, all making their own each and special contribution to life and fitting in to their own sphere and fulfilling the purpose of life. We cannot all perhaps shine like a rose in a royal garden, but all of us can bloom like the violet among the common hedgerows and along the pathways of life, and give happiness to each and to all. It is the using of the talents that we have to the best of our ability under all circumstances that counts for all and for everything as we travel on our journey of life. And in sharing with others, at the same time we're building up our own characters and we are enriching our own hearts. But now just another word about Gordon Chapel. The quail was rather deaf and he bought a new hearing aid, one of these headphone types. They were the old type, they were rather clumsy looking, and he couldn't be persuaded to put it on in chapel. But however, I was at their place to tea on one occasion, and together we persuaded him to put it on that evening, to put it on for the evening service in chapel. And he put it on. And the microphone was put right in front of me on the pulpit desk. And I was rather conscious of that microphone being there. And my voice was rather strong, of course. And I give full vent to what I was saying to the microphone. And I was often thinking afterwards, if Mr. Quail hadn't been deaf before that service, he certainly would have been deaf afterward. Then there was another celebrity attended the Gordon Chapel. He went by the name of Johnny Hall. He was a fisherman. He owned his own fishing vessel. He was very regular in his attendance. And in those days, they'd be having a short prayer meeting after the service. And Johnny Hall would be always one of the first to engage in prayer. His prayer was simply grand to listen to. It seemed like if he was on the real wavelength to heaven itself. And he could lift the congregation right to the celestial gates. And being a fisherman, he always introduced into his prayer the words of the scripture, O Lord, do thou bless them that go down to the sea in ships to do business in the waters thereof. I never remember him offering a prayer in the Gordon Chapel without bringing this quotation into his prayer. He was a great man of faith. On one occasion, the Peel fishing boats went out in the evening to their usual fishing ground, and during the night there was a very severe storm sprung up, and those in charge of the vessels thought it was better to make for the safety of Peel Harbour. And so they sailed back to the shelter of the harbour. In the early morning it was found that Johnny Hall's boat had not returned. It was missing. And the Peel lifeboat was sent out to look for Johnny Hall's fishing vessel. At last they located him. And he was what fishermen would call riding the storm, a lying tow. And when the lifeboat came within calling out distance, he called out to the men in the lifeboat, get away back to Peel, boys. The weather is bad. It's not safe for you to be out. Get away back to the safety of the harbour. Then my wife and I too enjoyed a very rich fellowship with Mona's uncle and aunt, Mr. and Mrs. Willie Garrett. We enjoyed that fellowship over many years. Some of these memories are very precious. Some of them very poignant, of course. Then I could say a whole lot of kind things about you, Kathleen, as well. I could tell about your heart of gold and your life of service and your visiting the aged and the infirm and the lonely, and your kind letters and all the really lovely things that you've been doing in your life of service. But at the moment, I'm not going to go any further on that point. I think I'll just better leave it for the time. I don't know really how what I've been saying is going to go down with folk who listen to it. So I'll have to get onto another line, I think. There was a Church of England clergyman. We Methodists often refer to these men as parsons, but I'll call them, in this instance, a Church of England clergyman. He gave up his living and was taken over by a young vicar. But there were lots of complaints against this young vicar. The complaints were that his sermons were far too short. The old vicar, he was long-winded. He preached long sermons, and they were very soothing, and the congregation were able to enjoy a real good sleep while he was preaching. And then, of course, they woke up refreshed when he'd finished. But with the new vicar, his sermons were short, and these good folk were just getting off to sleep when they were sharply wakened up again to sing the next hymn. And there were quite a number of complaints about it. And then there was a Methodist congregation. This goes back, it's a long time since I've heard this story, so they could have been Primitive Methodists, or they could have been Wesleyan Methodists. But they were noted for going to sleep during the service. And on one occasion there was a preacher thought he would teach them a lesson. So he conducted the preliminaries of the service, and then he gave out his text, and as he was delivering his sermon in a level, uneventful voice, one after another dropped off to sleep. And when he saw that the last man had dropped off to sleep, he picked up his hat and his umbrella, and still talking in the same tone of voice, he walked down the aisle and out through the door and left his congregation in blissful slumber. I remember on one occasion I was planned at Leggy Dhu Chapel many years ago. Leggy Dhu Chapel was the place where my wife, Mrs. Tia, worshipped before she took on the name of Mrs. Tia. And this particular Sunday, it was Sunday afternoon, and I think it must have been in the summertime. The weather was close and heavy anyway, but it was spilling rain, absolutely pouring down. And there were only two turned up for the service, the organist and her sister. And I said to these two ladies that it was hardly worthwhile holding a service in the afternoon now. The day was so bad, and you know everybody feels rather depressed when it's raining. Oh, they said, we must have a service. We'll have to have a service. Oh, yes, they said, we must have a service. So I agreed, and I went up into the pulpit and commenced the service, give out the first hymn, had prayer, give out the second hymn, and sung that. And then I read the lesson. Then I gave out the third hymn and sang that. As I was giving out my text, the organist moved back from the organ to sit alongside of her sister in the pew while I was delivering the sermon. And I had hardly given the text out when both these ladies were fast asleep. I know for a certainty that they heard the text, because I give the text out very deliberately. They heard the text. But I know for a certainty, too, that they never heard the sermon. In the Douglas Methodist circuit, when a new minister is invited from across the water, he usually comes about the last week in August, supposed to be in the new pulpit for the first Sunday in September. And the quarterly meeting is held the first week in September, and he receives a welcome at the quarterly meeting, just the usual welcome that a minister receives. But he receives the official welcome then at the circuit rally. It's held about the third week in October. And quite a number of years ago, a young minister, the Reverend Derek Mailer, was invited to the Douglas circuit. He used to be stationed at Ancon. And it was announced in the press some weeks before he came that he was coming, but the press spelled his name as Mailer, M for Nelly, when his name was Mailer, M for Maggie. So I think he must have either seen this in the paper or somebody must have told him about it. But he came to the island, he was a splendid young fellow, and he received this usual welcome at the quarterly meeting, and then he received the official welcome at the circuit rally. It was held on that particular occasion in Victoria Street, quite a big gathering. And after he had received his welcome, he made a supply. And in his supply he said, "When I was coming here to the Isle of Man," he said, "you didn't know anything at all about me. You didn't know," he said, "anything. You didn't even know," he said, "how to spell my name." So he must have seen the announcement in the press. And when I got on the boat at Liverpool, he said, to sail over the island, there was a young honeymoon couple got on the same boat. And he said that the young bridegroom felt that he was in charge of the young bride. He offered her every attention and he was taking full care of her and full charge. And he seemed to think quite a lot about her. And after we were about an hour sailing, said Mr. Mailer, the young bride began to get sick. She became very ill indeed. And the young man was pushing round, he said. He felt that she was in his charge and he didn't know what to do. He was very embarrassed over the situation. And he was very excited and perhaps a bit confused. And she looked at him and she swung her arm around and she said, get away. If I'm going to be sick, I'm going to be sick alone. And the young man, he said, came away with a very dazed look in his eyes, because it was only that morning that he had taken his vows to love her in sickness and in health. But he didn't expect, he said, that she was going to be sick so soon. So he came up to me, said the Reverend Mailer, to try and cover his embarrassment and make some conversation. And he said to me, "Are you going to the Isle of Man?" Rather a silly question, said Mr. Mailer, because we were over an hour sailing with the Isle of Man. But however, I answered yes. And then he said, "It's a fine place, the Isle of Man." And Mr. Mailer said again, "Yes." And then the young man said again, "There are grand people over there in the Isle of Man." And Mr. Mailer answered again, "Yes." And then the young man said, "Well, how long are you going for?" And Mr. Mailer said, "Well, I don't know really, perhaps 2 years or maybe even 3 years." "Oh," said the young man, "you're going to work." He said, "I'm not going to work. I'm going," he said, "on my honeymoon." I'd just like to say that Mr. Mailer turned out to be a splendid young minister. He gave excellent service. And as a rule, a young man on these days, perhaps 3 or even at the longest 4 years, when it came to the time for Mr. Miller to move, we were very sorry indeed. And at that time I happened to be circuit steward, and I received a long distance phone call from someplace in England, I forget where it was now, a circuit steward in England who was inquiring about Mr. Miller. He said that they had his name before them as a likely candidate to be invited to their circuit, and would I give my opinion of Mr. Miller? Well, I said, it wasn't my policy to speak about anybody, especially about ministers, over the phone. But on this occasion, I could speak with a clear and with an open mind, because Mr. Miller, we found him one of the best. He was a very good preacher. He was of a very friendly disposition. And he was a good visitor, and he'd get on very well, and we were only too sorry that he had to move on. And this circuit steward said, well, we've got his name before us to invite him anyway. And if we do invite...